The guard came back into the room, bringing a palm-sized two-way radio to Gaetano. Nothing came from it but a hiss of static. In the shadows cast by the candles, Dan smiled grimly. The Yamagata teams knocked out every electrical and electronic circuit in the place, must have thumped the castle with a hell of an electromagnetic pulse.
"On your feet, all of you," Gaetano snapped. "Something is happening here. You will each be taken to separate rooms. Do not try to leave those rooms until we have things under control. The doors will be locked and guarded. If this is an attack on the castle, you will be used as hostages. All of you."
Jane looked over her shoulder toward Dan as one of the guards took her by the arm and headed for the door. Malik was pushed forward by another guard, none too gently. In the semi-darkness, it was hard to make out the expression on Gaetano's face. At least, thought Dan, he doesn't seem so cocky anymore. Two guards grabbed his arms and moved him toward the kitchen, away from the others. "Going to keep us separated," Dan realized. They passed Gaetano, who was banging the two-way on the table. Dan laughed inwardly. "When it doesn't work, hammer it. That'll do a lot of good." The kitchen was even darker than the dining hall, lit only by a pair of battery-powered emergency lamps placed above each of its two doors. In the thick shadows, the rows of heavy pots and skillets hanging from their overhead racks looked like an arsenal of medieval weapons. Dan knew there were plenty of knives around, too, but he could not see any in the thick shadows. But there was a big steaming pot on the stove. Dan stumbled, staggered, let his arms go limp in the grasp of his two guards. They tried to yank him to his feet, but Dan hung limply between them, moaning as theatrically as he dared. They lowered him to the floor, speaking to each other in swift Italian. Dan realized that they intended to carry him, one at his shoulders, the other at his feet. He kicked with both feet at the guard's knees, knocking him to the floor with a surprised yelp of pain, and pulled the other one down headfirst to sprawl on top of him. Wriggling to his feet, Dan grabbed the steaming pot as the guard reached for his shoulder holster. He saw the boiling water coming and tried to duck out of its way, but Dan flung it at him, pot and all. He screamed as Dan wrung his hands in pain. The pot's metal hand grips had been scalding hot. The other guard was scrambling to his feet. Dan reached overhead, grabbed a heavy iron skillet, and banged him on the head with it. He fell sideways. Dan swung the skillet again, ignoring the pain in his hand. It sounded like a cathedral clock's gong. For good measure, he bashed the scalded one, too. They both lay silent on the tiled floor. As Dan pawed the two bodies for their pistols, he heard gunshots. Muffled, far away, but definitely gunshots. The battle's on, and Gaetano's going to use Jane as a shield for himself. Jamming the two pistols into the belt of his Levi's, wringing his painful hands, Dan headed back toward the dining hall. 42. The dining hall was empty. The table still set with food in the dishes and wine in the goblets. The candles flickered fitfully in the draft from the open door at the far side of the chamber. Dan made his way to the central hall. It was as dark as a cave, not even moonlight sifting through the long narrow windows. Dan knew that the main staircase was off to his right, and that Gaetano had probably taken Jane up that way. More gunshots, closer, the rattle of automatic weapons. He could hear shouting now, heavy, angry voices yelling back and forth. They're not using tranquilizer darts, he knew. Gingerly pulling one of the automatic pistols from his belt, his palm and fingers raw from their scalding, he realized that he would be firing real bullets. "And they'll be shooting to kill you, pal. Hope Nobo's team has night vision gear. I'd hate to be shot by my own side." He groped across the central hall toward the main staircase, the pistol heavy in his hand. Slowly, carefully, like a blind man without a cane, he slid one foot in front of the other until finally he butted against the first step of the staircase. He started up the steps. Uncertain of how high or deep they were, he nearly tripped on the first one. "Cripes," he thought. "If I fall down, the gun in my belt might just shoot my cojones off." So he pulled the second pistol out with his left hand and proceeded slowly, gropingly, up the wide stone staircase, feeling slightly ridiculous, like a cowboy gunslinger in an old video with a gun in each hand. He heard footsteps running against the stone floor up above. a voice speaking low and swift in Italian. He froze on the steps. If I can't see them, they can't see me, Dan told himself. The thin beam of a flashlight lanced through the darkness, sweeping erratically along the staircase. Dan flattened himself against the steps. The flashlight beam swung toward him, hazy with dust motes.
Eccolo, fucile!
Somebody at the top of the stairs sprayed a fusillade of automatic rifle fire at Dan. Bullets whined and cracked all around him. Stone chips flew from the steps and walls, slashing his back, his arms, his cheek. He remembered that the last time he had fired a pistol had been on a target range in Texas, nearly 30 years earlier. And he had been a rotten shot. Big George had been down in the servants' quarters, as befits a chauffeur, when the lights went out. The job Nobuhiko had given him was to make contact with Kate Williams and stay with her wherever she went. Nobo's reasoning was that even if Dan and Malik failed to reach Jane, the only reason that Kate had left Alphonsus was to rendezvous with Gaetano. Therefore, George was fitted out with a biochip earplug and told to be ready to move at an instant's notice. Yamagata personnel tracked Kate from the Nueva Venezuela space station to Milan's sprawling, busy airport. She boarded a private plane. Satellite sensors picked up the plane as it cleared the airport, while Yamagata agents pried its flight plan out of the airport computer. Kate was heading for Cagliari, on Sardinia. Hasty plans were made. George and a pair of young Yamagata agents, a man and a woman, were picked up from the yacht by a chartered jet seaplane and flown at top speed to the airport at Cagliari. Breathlessly searching the small airport, they found the limousine waiting for Kate's arrival just a few minutes before Kate's own plane touched down. So swiftly and quietly that no one noticed, the two Japanese took the driver and security guard away at gunpoint. That was how Big George, feeling silly in an ill-fitting chauffeur's uniform, drove Kate to the castle. The original chauffeur, together with Gaetano's security guard, remained at the airport under the watchful eyes of the two Yamagata people. He had thoughtfully taped the directions to the castle onto the limo's dashboard, saving himself an unpleasant interrogation by the Japanese, both of whom spoke Italian. George did not, but he was counting on the hope that a mere chauffeur would be almost invisible to the people at the castle. He explained to Kate along the way who he was and what was happening at the castle. She said nothing, merely acknowledged his story with a nod that he saw in the rearview mirror. Big George was hardly invisible. The minute he stopped the limo in the castle courtyard and trotted around to let Kate out, one of the narrow-eyed guards stepped up to the pair of them, one hand on the barrel of the shotgun he wore slung over his shoulder. He said something in Italian, his voice suspicious.
"This is my driver," Kate replied. "I brought him with me. Good thing, too. Your people never showed up at the airport."
The guard said in hesitant English,
"What do you mean?"
"You Latin types don't know how to meet an airplane at the time it's specified to land, that's what I mean," Kate said. "Your people are probably still at the airport bar, ogling the waitresses."
She strode off toward Gaetano and the others clustered around him, leaving George to fend for himself. They clearly did not trust him, but George spoke to them loudly in his worst Aussie accent, cheerfully let them search him until he thought they might be falling in love with his body, and finally was grudgingly allowed to go down to the servants' quarters. He made a strange contrast to the dour, dark, swarthy, silent maids and valets. A massive, shaggy, red-haired giant who talked loud and non-stop to hide his anxiety at being alone among the enemy. The food was good, at least. Lunch was large and tasty, with pasta and actual veal, and plenty of strong red wine to wash it all down. George avoided the wine almost altogether. He was shown to a narrow little room with a cot in it and gratefully took an afternoon nap. Soon after he woke up, the women were setting the table again for dinner. The meal was almost finished when the lights went out. George knew immediately that the Yamagata assault team had arrived at last. He got up from the table amid the babble of the Italians' voices and headed through the sudden darkness toward the courtyard. Sure enough, the sky outside was fairly filled with shimmering black parasails gliding in, bearing armored, helmeted figures beneath them, each of them bristling with weapons. There was firing from the windows, and the invaders fired back while still soaring earthward, knocking chips of stone from the walls and parapets. One of the first men